This is Talk To Me, the official podcast of MetalNexus.net. Your hosts, Joshua Toomey and John Drake, bring you epic rants, anecdotes, and interviews with heavy hitters from hardcore
A New Life Begins!
To hair metal. This is Talk To Me.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Talk To Me. This is episode 132. The guest this week is the mighty Rob Flynn of Machine Head. And we also have Rob Rivera's pick from the kit. As always, I'm your host, Joshua Toomey, and not joined this week by John Drake. He's off doing his Star Wars podcast. Our schedules could not line up this week, so I'm flying solo this week. But man, got a great chat with Rob Flynn coming up. Nice hour-long chat with some music and everything. So I'm going to get right to the business of things and get right to the chat. Let's head over to the Facebook for a nice five-star Facebook review. I need some more iTunes reviews, though. We need the iTunes reviews. If you're watching live on Facebook Live, head over to the iTunes and leave a nice five-star rating, a nice five-star review, and it will be read on an upcoming episode of the podcast. But this one comes from Rico Kohler, and backstory, Rico Kohler is my former drummer of 12 Volt Negative Earth. So he says, just listened to the Wes Borland episode and cannot believe that you don't remember how you heard he was from Nashville. Carter Hasselbrook from Asbestos was best friends with him growing up, even went to 4-H camp with the guy. In fact, in the liner notes for Significant Other, Carter is the only guy that is thanked by a first and last name. So for that reason alone, I'm going to give you a very star search score of 4¾ stars. And if you're old enough to remember Star Search, that will be funny. But of course, my score for the overall Talk To Me podcast is a sounding 5 out of 5 stars, my friend. Love you, dude. Well, Rico Kohler, I love you too. So thanks for the nice 5-star rating on Facebook. If you guys can't do the iTunes review, make sure to head over to Facebook and hit up a nice 5-star review on Facebook. But we always love those nice 5-star reviews on iTunes. And I'm not going to do shout-outs for sharing. It's been a few weeks. The Rob Rivera episode was fun. I hope you guys enjoyed the best of podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed that too. And we're starting a new year, 2018. Welcome to the new year. Welcome to 2018 for Talk To Me. And what a huge guest for the first week of the podcast, Rob Flynn of Machine Head, one of my all-time favorite bands and one of my all-time favorite dudes. So yeah, let's go ahead and get into Rob Rivera's pick from the kit, and then we will talk to Rob Flynn.
What's up, everybody? This is Rob Rivera from Nonpoint. This is my pick from the kit, Machine Head Old, from the debut album Burn My Eyes. I first heard this song in 1984. I actually bought the CD the day before it came out. It was at in the used bin. It was so weird. It was in the used bin and Uncle Sam's Records in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I put it in, you know, Davidian being the first song, but when Old kicked in and that first riff kicked in, I was completely blown away. And it was a game changer, a life-changing record for me. Put my belief back in metal. I mean, around that time, you know, we had Biohazard and Sepultura and Pantera. And from that first Machine Head record, it's basically a combination of all three of those bands, you know. There was hip-hop in there, there was thrash, there was, you know, metal. There was a lot of different influences on that record, and it is very welcoming to me seeing how Rob Flynn had come from the Violence days and his previous band, the Total Fast-Ass Thrash Band from San Francisco. And I was very blown away with that first record. I saw him live on that cycle, opening up for Slayer and Biohazard, I think it was, yeah. So, and then I saw them with Stuck Mojo and two times on that record. Incredible record, still a classic, probably from front to back, one of my top 20 albums. And one of the songs that I actually had the honor to fill in for Machine Head in Lacrosse, Wisconsin. It was under unfortunate circumstances because Dave McLean's mom had fortunately passed away, but they couldn't. They had already canceled one show, and you know, when you're on tour, you're on a tight budget, and you have to kind of meet the budget. So all the drummers from the tour, Vinnie Paul and Mark from Bury Your Dead and myself, played the Machine Headset, and that was the song that was picked for me, as Rob always said, that I was a groove drummer. And I played that one, actually, Aesthetics of Hate. So this song holds a huge, it's a big part of my life, just because of the history behind it, of me loving it, and me actually being able to play with Machine Head and play that song. The song that actually made me fall in love with the band was a huge, huge thing that I'll never forget. But here you go, this is Machine Head's Old.
We'll be right back.
right, guys, that was Rob Rivera's pick from the kit. That was Old from Machine Head. And from one Rob to another, man, we got Rob Flynn on the line. What's going on, man?
Thanks for having me. Used to be in a... We took Primer 55 out back in 2000 on the Year of the Dragon tour, but I don't...
I was not in the band at that time. No, I was not in the band at the time. Actually, I ended up auditioning for them soon after that, because I remember Bobby still had his Machine Head jacket, you know, with like with the Machine Head, it was a Machine Head windbreaker, and he had the little Machine Head logos going down it, and I was like, man, I wish I could have got to tour with Machine Head,
the black and red one.
Yeah. I ended up joining after the second album came out, and I got to tour like we talked about earlier. We toured with Dope and Skin Lab. And I did some stuff like that. So yeah, that was my Primer 55 days. I was actually in my notes. I was gonna see if they were as dysfunctional when you were touring with them as they were when I was touring with them.
I mean, I wouldn't have known. You know what I mean? Like, we were just hanging out and drinking. I hung out a lot with Bobby. I loved Bobby, man.
Yeah, he's
Bobby. I called him Bobby Brown Eye because I drink a drink called the Brown Eye, and Bobby would always come over after our show and be like, "You got a Brown Eye?" And I was like, "Bobby Brown Eye." He's awesome. He's a good dude, man.
Yeah, he's a great dude.
I really liked him. I haven't seen him in a long time, and you know, I don't know if you're still talking to those guys, but shout out to Bobby Brown Eye.
Last time I talked to him, they did a because he resurrected Primer in 07, and I did the reunion tours with them, and then he kept it going until just a couple of years ago, and they played a show here in Louisville, and I went out and I played loose with them and stuff like that, and that's the last time I've really talked to him. I've texted with him here and there, but I don't really we don't send Christmas cards to one another or anything. Good dude though, man. I was actually in the room when he got the Soulfly gig, because we were doing a separate band.
He was in Soulfly for a good spell, right?
Yeah, I think he was on four albums with them, and I remember he was kind of like asking me for permission to go join Soulfly. He was like, "Do you mind if I do this?" And I looked at him, I'm like, "You're a fucking idiot if you don't. You know, we're not gonna waste our way here and you know trying to do this other band." But yeah, it's he's a good dude, man. Good times. But man, let's kind of jump into the album and stuff. I mean, you've been on a press tear lately, and so it's kind of hard to get into too many new questions that I haven't already heard you answer. So I'm going to kind of bounce off of some of the answers you've already given. The one thing I did want to kind of get into was, I'm thankful that you're talking about this new album and saying it's going to be softer than some of the previous albums, because I can't stand when a band will come out and say, "Man, this is the heaviest album we've ever done," and then you get it and you're like, "Did you guys even listen to this?"
Yeah. I do these Facebook Live and these YouTube Live things, and you know, people are asking me, and I do them every Friday, every Tuesday, and people are asking me, like, "What's the new record like?" Because we started broadcasting from the studio after a while, and it was like, I can't say that this is the not the heaviest record we've ever done. In fact, it might be the most grooving and melodic record we've ever done, and it's the least thrashiest we've been in a good 14 years. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just said that, like, I literally just said that, and I said, you know, lower your expectations for the heaviness,
right?
And of course, it kind of freaked people out. And I think especially metal fans are really conditioned to metal bands going, "It's the fucking heaviest ever, bro."
Right.
Or, "It's heavy, but it's our most melodic." You know, it's in just like the same two answers. And after I thought about it, I was like, you know, I realize that this is going to jar some people and freak some people out because it's not what they want to hear. But I feel that come January, you're going to appreciate that, you know, I shot it straight with you, and you know, you know what your expectations are, you know, cause I think it's really easy when we're at this part of the game, you know, 2 months or 6 weeks before the record drops, like, I could make somebody think it's fucking Rain and Blood if I wanted to, and that would be insincere. And so, you know, I think it's easy to get into that. You get asked the same fucking questions. You want to kind of hype it in whatever way, but you know, I think that, you know, the thing that I'm most proud of is we've got some really melodic moments on this record that are fucking awesome. You know, we got a song like Bastards, or we got songs like Behind a Mask that are literally us. No, no heavy guitars, no heavy vocals. This is a first for us. And I'm really proud of that. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm really proud that we were able to find this strange balance between writing these really, really heavy songs and making these really amazing mellow songs.
Everything I've heard off of the new album sounds like Machine Head. So it's not like it's cool. A complete departure from what you guys have been up to. So, I mean, awesome. Do you feel like maybe like this was the path of the band and maybe where it was going?
Yeah, for us, whenever we start writing a record, there's no plan, there's no rules, there's no guide. And even if we have a discussion about, I might like to go here, which I can tell you, I can remember maybe one conversation like that in 25 years. We just start writing. And, you know, sometimes that first song totally sets the tone. And you're just like, oh my God, like we're fucking killing it. And I know exactly where we're going. And other times, the first couple of songs don't even make, you know, I think for The Blackening, the first two songs we wrote didn't even make the record.
Wow.
You know, like we had no idea. And then the first four songs we wrote for The Blackening were the four shortest songs on the record. It was Slanderous, Beautiful Morning, Aesthetics, Now I Lay Thee Down. For a good 5 months, there was no indication that we were going to write four 10-minute long songs after that. And then we just did. And we don't have a clock in our jam room, so we didn't even realize they were 10 minutes long. We were just playing and we were like, this is cool. And then we timed it one day and we're like, holy shit, these songs are 10 minutes long. What the fuck are we doing?
Right.
And you know, it's funny because I freaked out. I was like, oh my God, like we can't have four 10-minute long songs. Like we're becoming self-absorbed musicians. Like we got to shorten them and trim the fat. And we trimmed the fat and we shortened them. We shortened them, those four songs, Clenching, Halo, Wolves, and Farewell to Arms, down to 5 and 6 minutes. And we lived with it for about a week. And it was like taking the loop-de-loops out of a roller coaster. It sucked.
Yeah.
And we just put it back to the way it was. And we're like, I don't know if this is going to work. Like, I don't know if our fans are going to get this, but this just feels right. So let's fucking go for it. And that's what this record, a lot of this record reminded me of that time in a different way and for different reasons. But a lot of it is like, I don't know if our fans are going to get the shit that we're doing on this record. And I don't really care because we like it and it feels right.
Yeah, I think, and I'm glad you guys didn't cut down those songs on The Blackening, because, you know, they're like musical journeys. They're not just, you know, the flavor of the week pop songs. I mean, they're, you know, you throw on The Blackening, you're going to listen to that from beginning to end. You're not just listening to it for the hits. You know, that's a you know, you're going on a trip with Machine Head with that album.
Right.
And, you know, with the new album, I honestly haven't heard all of it. I've heard a few of the songs that have been released. I didn't get the proper...
Oh, okay. Oh, they didn't send you the tracks?
I didn't get the proper email or whatnot to get the full range. But, I mean, I've heard you talking about it, and I know that, you know, this is kind of a departure from the last few albums, but it's still Machine Head from what I
got to say, that really bums me out.
What's that?
That you haven't heard it.
I know.
That you haven't heard it, because, like, I don't, you know, it's... I feel like, you know...
What I'll probably get the email tomorrow.
It doesn't make it harder to explain it to you, but it just like I would have loved for you to have heard it.
Right.
I prefer for people to have heard it before I talk to them.
Right. And I get it. And like I said, I'll probably get the email tomorrow. Like, oh, here's the new album. I think I had to sign up for Nuclear Blast's promo list and, you know, okay, get approved and all that
stuff.
Oh,
so it's your fault. Okay.
Yes, it's 100% my fault. It's definitely not Amy's fault.
All right, well, I don't feel so bad. You blew it.
Ah, I'm the worst. But I kind of wanted to go back. I mean, I've been listening to Machine Head since I was, 94? What was that, 94 when the first album came out?
Yeah, first record, 94.
So I was 15. Obviously, it came up because you were on Roadrunner, and at that time, if you were a metal band and on Roadrunner, I was going to buy the album no matter what, because Monty
right?
And everybody over there knew what they were doing. But I remember the ads were for fans of Biohazard, Pantera, and Sepultura, and I was like, I'm sold. You know, so yeah, I mean, I remember, and I believe you were on the Demon Knight soundtrack too, which was kind of odd.
Yes.
There was two unknown bands on the Demon Knight soundtrack. One was Machine Head and the other was Filter, but at the time.
Yeah, right? Oh, that's right. That was like Filter's kind of big break, huh?
Yep. Maybe it was yours too, but you know, just listening through
the... No, it was definitely their big break. It was not our big break.
Well, it was.
They definitely got that. They got the hit out of that. That was like the one song that everybody knows Filter for. I don't think they had any other song after that.
Well, they had that one.
They had the ballad, right?
Yeah, the take a picture or something. I don't remember.
Yeah.
The one thing I was gonna go with was, I mean, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. There's one instance in your career, we'll say after Supercharger came out, and you know the Burning Red had come out, and I loved it, but you know not a lot of people did. Supercharger comes out. You guys, I don't know when this tour was, and maybe you can jog my memory, but it was Lamb of God, Machine Head, and Gojira was opening.
And Trivium.
It might have been that too, but I'm trying to... I remember I saw that show in Nashville, and I feel like it was kind of a lull in the Machine Head world, but everyone in the place was going nuts, and you asked the crowd, you know, how many people have seen Machine Head before. Or no, you asked like how many people was first time seeing Machine Head, and like everyone raised their hand. And I remember even looking at your face, and you were like almost shocked because of how like that was the most insane crowd I'd ever seen for a Machine Head show. And it was like all new kids. It was like the Machine Head like rejuvenated fan base or something. Did you maybe notice that on that tour? Am I like way out of bounds like thinking that way?
I mean, you brought up Supercharger, and then you're talking about the Blackening tour. That was the first tour for the Blackening. So that's a pretty big space of time in between those two. That's a good 7 years apart. With Supercharger, you know, the Burning Red was definitely a different record, but it was, you know, I mean, that's our second biggest record even now.
Yeah.
So it did really well. It was different in the sense that it was really us expanding, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, kind of like what we're doing with this new record, you know. I've been saying that too. Like, I feel like this record could be the record that came after the Burning Red, you know, because the Burning Red was really us, you know. I think with that record, I really felt like we had backed ourselves into a corner. Like, we did Burn My Eyes, came out strong out the gate, and then with our second record, we kind of had that sophomore slump, and I didn't want to go heavier because I just felt like the times were changing, and you know, I felt, you know, I had just kind of, you know, had gone through some big changes in my life, and I started going to therapy, and I started like digging up all this shit from my fucking past, you know, I had a really dysfunctional childhood and family, and we got really melodic, you know, and what came out of that time period with the music was this really melodic music, and there was rapping, and there's always been rapping on Machine Head records. It was a little more front and center, you know, but for me, when I look at that record, to me, the biggest change is really like in the melody. You know, that's where we really, like, I became completely unafraid to sing. Like, I totally got confidence in singing, and singing a lot. Like, I could sing through a whole song and be okay with it. Like, before, I could never do that. I could never do that. You know, and before, we were playing with fucking grindcore bands and hardcore bands and death metal bands, and it was like, all right, I'm just going to fucking do the heaviest I can do. And somewhere in there, you know, touring, you just know that you can do something else, and you believe in yourself, and I tried it, and it really just expanded where we could go. And to me, that record, you know, maybe, you know, sometimes when the pendulum swings the other way, it can go a little too far. And I think maybe, you know, when I look at that record, like the way we were dressed, you know, I fucking had blonde and black hair and shit, you know, like people were just like, what the fuck? Like, and it sounds totally different. And so I think from a visual standpoint, it was a little more shocking. And a friend of mine once said, people listen with their eyes. Mm-hmm. And I believe that. And I think that 20 years, you know, it's almost 20 years old now. That record in 2019, it's going to be the 20-year anniversary of the Burning Red. That those songs stood the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew they did even then. You know, so take away the From This Day video, take away whatever you thought about me. I didn't fucking care. I loved it. I'm fucking in a rock band. I'm a fucking rock star. I can do whatever the fuck I want. You know, like, right. It's fun. You know, by most standards, I was actually probably pretty tame by some of the fucking other bands of the time.
Well, what's funny, and I'll agree with you on that, because I mean, you know, I grew up listening to Megadeth, Metallica, Slayer, you know, obviously got into Machine Head when you guys first came out. But I mean, I evolved. I mean, in 1999, I had blonde and brown dreadlocks that were down, you know, down half down exactly. My back, and I would have, you know, totally loved an orange, you know, track jacket. And,
fuck yeah!
And so I mean, I don't hate on you for that at all. I mean, I saw that tour exactly. too. I saw that tour.
And it's
with,
like the fucking, you know, and like it's funny because you say it was the style of the time. It was the style of the time. Like, you know, you look back at it now and you're like, I just think it's fuck. I don't care. I don't give a fuck about it at all.
Yeah.
I look back on that and it's just like fucking great to me. You know, I look at my first video, I'm rocking cornrows in the Davidian video. We're walking around with fucking pit bulls and walking through Oakland. Like, it's a rap video.
Yeah.
Like, how nobody missed this gigantic rap influence on our band, I'll never understand. You know what I mean? Like, we were recreating a rap video straight up.
Right.
And, you know, so to me, I just look at it. I always believe that I'm a firm believer that bands should have a look, man. Like, you should be larger than life up there. When you get up on that stage, you should project all the way to the very back of the venue. You should be larger than life. And I love it when bands have a look. I don't really like it when bands just kind of look like a bunch of fucking nothing staring at their feet. Like, that never has done anything for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that record, we kind of rolled with it. And Supercharger, you know, Supercharger, I tell you what, man, it gets a bad rap for sure. But that record, those songs kill live. People lose their shit to those. We play Bulldozer,
yeah.
Motherfuckers go crazy. Now especially, because it's like a Machine Head classic. You know, it's 17 years old,
yeah.
Or 16 years old. It's pretty much a bona fide classic at this point. The title track, Supercharger, the song Crashing Around You. And it's funny because I think if you only look at the time, right? Like when a record's released, if you just gauge it by what people think right then and right there, it's a little bit skewed, right? Because I feel like music has this butterfly effect. You know, it has this thing, and maybe songs that people don't need right then, they go back whenever, a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, and they need that song then, and they need that music then. And that's the one thing that I continually hear about those two records, which by all accounts, and like, if you ask anybody in the media, oh yeah, that's when everybody's fan, our fans didn't leave us. You know, we were selling out Irving Plaza, selling out the Fillmore, selling out Brixton Academy. Like, if all of our fans left us, we couldn't sell out 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 seaters. So, you know, I think that people have gone back, and again, the music stood the test of time. And yeah, it was a tough time in the media for us because they basically said, fuck you. I mean, straight up said, we're not covering anything by your band. You know, you have to reach a sales. I mean, I remember on Through the Ashes, Revolver magazine, the editor at the time said, you got to sell 40,000 records in order for us to do a story on you. We sold 40,000 records. You got to sell 50,000 records. Okay. We sold 50,000 records. You got to sell 60,000 records. We sold 60,000 records. Then they said, well, the record's too old. We can't do a story on you.
Wow.
You know, and it was like that kind of shit. And, you know, so from a media standpoint, it really was hard. And like, this is kind of like the beginning of the internet still. So, you know, people still looked at magazines as important. So if you didn't get coverage in a magazine, you know, I mean, back in the early 90s, man, you didn't get coverage in a magazine. You may have well have not have existed. Like, it was that type of thing. You could be the biggest band in the Bay Area, but if any of the press of the time didn't cover you, you didn't exist and nobody heard of you. And that all started to change around Supercharger, you know. And by the end of Supercharger, you know, I had a couple of buddies who were doing our website, and they were younger, and they were turning me on to like message boards. This is all like pre MySpace, right? So turning me on to message boards and turning me on to all this, like, you know, like these are ways that you can interact with your fan and post videos and post pictures and put, and I was like, wow, this is this is incredible. And like, it's like, you could never, you know, I remember the days of writing letters and getting letters from all kinds of dudes in jail and shit, you know, and writing them back. And, you know, in a weird way, we took to the internet with gusto. And it sounds absurd to say this now because it's like, you know, everybody has the internet now, but this is like the very beginning of the internet, 98, 99. And we really took to it, and we started, because there was no, and in a lot of ways, it was because we had no other option. We couldn't get press. No one would cover us. And if they did cover us, it was always bullshit. They had an agenda. They wanted to slam us. It was like build them up, tear them down. So even if we had a great show, we had a problem. And so we just started taking it directly to the fans, and we started making videos. I was blogging a lot, and I'd always written diaries. I used to write for magazines, and just started doing that. And it became this really important way to get our story out to what our fans, and we were brutally honest, man. Like, I was like, you know, after Supercharger, we left Roadrunner, and we went for a long time without being signed, and we got rejected by 35 labels. 35 labels shot us down after Supercharger. Wow. And all of these labels had been courting us, like, as soon as you get off Roadrunner, you're right on us, man. Like, we'll sign you right away. We're like, fuck yeah. So we got up, you know, we told Roadrunner, we're leaving, you know, let us go. You know, you haven't honored your contract. And eventually they did. And so we approached all those labels and we're like, all right,
we're here.
We are. Like, sign us.
Machine Head's here. Let's
they're like,
do it.
They're like, slow down. Like, slow down. We're not ready to sign you. And this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, so I sat there and, you know, there was a point when we got picked up by Roadrunner Europe, and we were supposed to get picked up by Roadrunner again. And at the last minute, the U.S. side of it said, we don't think there's any gas left in the engine, and we're going to pass. And we had just signed with the European division of Roadrunner. And so it was a pretty heavy blow, because we were like, wow, that means our record's coming out in Europe, but not in America at the same time. We're kind of fucked. And I just basically went on, you know, after I dealt with it for a while, I went online and I talked to our friends directly, not through magazines, not through anybody, but I talked right to the head cases. And I said, hey, this is the deal. You know, for the last year and a half, we've been unsigned. We've been rejected by 35 labels, and we just re-signed with Roadrunner Europe. Unfortunately, Roadrunner America is going to pass, and that's their prerogative. They don't have to sign us. And so we're going to put this record out, and we'll keep you posted. And we kind of took everybody on this journey with us, and fans really rallied behind us. Our American audience really respected that we were so just fucking straightforward with it, man. We just told it how it was. And when it was all said and done, we dropped the record, and the record fucking hit like a fucking nuclear bomb. Like, it blew up over in Europe. It was massive. And the tour was massive. And so about 3 months later, Roadrunner America came back. And they're like, hey. And then all these other labels that had just passed on us came back, and they're like, hey. And eventually, you know, we just signed with Roadrunner because we thought it was a good look, and it was just, you know, good to be back in the same graces. It was a different, very different deal. And then we went about rebuilding it, man. And all of that, I chalk a lot of that up to being able to have that direct contact with our fans. But like I said, even after we got signed with Roadrunner, no magazines would cover us in America. Not one. Like, not one magazine covered us.
That's so crazy. And actually, that's something I wanted to talk to you about a little bit too, was, you know, you've been on a press, you know, tear lately. And, you know, you're talking in the 90s, you know, you would do your Circus magazine, Rip magazine, Metal Edge, Metal Hammer, Kerrang, and then, you know, basically do the magazines. But now, yeah, I'm sure you're getting, like, you know, joesmetalblog.com is calling you up, and, yeah, and, you know, Talk To Me podcast, you know, just like, you know, podcasts and blogs and so much stuff coming at you. You know, how are you kind of embracing all of this, you know, the new media that's kind of popped up over the last, you know, five or so years?
I love it. I think it's fucking great. Yeah. I mean, I don't love all of it. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of dudes out there with iPhones making a website, making a metal website. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, they don't know the knowledge. And so I think that kind of waters it down. You know, there's a lot of upstarts, and it's just like, to me, I'm a believer in quality over quantity, you know, and I've told that to everybody that we're working with, but I love it, man. I listen to podcasts all the time. Like, I love all the fucking, you know, I mean, I don't read magazines anymore. I don't even know where to get a magazine anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I can't fucking go to, there's no bar, like all the Barnes and Nobles in my area fucking closed down. Like, there's literally no, I mean, I think Revolver, and I sound like I'm bagging on Revolver, and I don't want to bag on Revolver because, you know, they've been really good to us. You know, the new people came in, and the new people are fucking awesome. And even the previous regime before them were awesome. But I don't know where to get a magazine anymore. You know, I haven't read, I mean, I know the UK still got like a pretty strong magazine culture, but here in America, it seemed like it's all gone online. You know, now it's like you read Metal Sucks, or you read, you know, Lamb Goat or Metal Injection, or you listen to podcasts or any of that, you know, or even just like, I find out more information just fucking scrolling through Twitter and my Instagram feed at this point.
Yeah. You know, are you doing your own personal podcast? Is that out there? Is that something that people should be looking for?
I started doing it, and it's not out there yet. And so I've just been, you know, like when you start, at least what everybody's told me is you try and get like a collection of stuff to drop so that it's not just one and then, you know, a month or so between the next one. So I've just been in the process of doing it, and it's cool. You know, like it's going to be called No Fucking Regrets, or No Effing Regrets, nice. At least online. And it's going to be about, you know, I've been talking to people. Like, I've interviewed Lars. I've interviewed the Sworn Lars from Rancid. I interviewed Sworn Enemy guys. And it's like, basically the premise is at some point you make a decision in your life that you don't look back. You know, like, you don't really know what the future holds, and you don't, you know, but you don't look back, and you just kind of take that step. And not everybody does that. You know what I mean? Like, not everybody gets to that point. And so it's kind of like, why did you get to that point? You know, so it's been cool. And I'm going to have I'm going to do it a lot on tour. I'm going to do it a lot to the point where, you know, we're bringing in other band guys, and just kind of make it even more so than a podcast. It's going to be kind of like a little bit of interview stuff. It's going to be life on the road shit. You know, when the crew starts arguing, there's going to be crew beef. So it's going to be crew beef. Nice. Dudes are gonna have to work it out on the podcast.
Sit them down. Yeah, there's nothing better than some good crew beef.
Because, you know, the crew takes over. Those motherfuckers take over your shit.
So, well, it's gonna kind of be hard for you if you're not taking an opening band out. You're not gonna have that opening band there to pick from. So you're just gonna have to pull bands from, you know, if you're playing a certain city that a band lives in.
Yeah, I mean, we always get friends coming over and friends come visit us on tour. So those kind of situations.
So we'll jump into that. I mean, obviously the Evening with the Machine Head show, I got to see it in 2015 in Louisville, Kentucky. I loved it, man. I you know, it was one of those things where when I heard it was announced, I was excited for it. When I saw it was coming to town, I was even more excited for it. And I went and checked it out, man. And you know, 2.5-3 hours, however long it was, I still could have taken more. It was a great night.
Awesome. Awesome, man.
I'll second your talk about when you play songs like, you know, off of The Burning Red and even stuff off of Supercharger. I mean, the place went nuts. So they definitely have standed the test of time. But I do have one pitch for you for this next go around. Honestly, I think you should do wardrobe changes and, you know, come out with some cornrows and your septum, you know, and a jersey, and then kind of move it on to the orange track jacket, and, you know, and then come
go
on
through,
you know,
all of the. Yeah. Did you ever see that video? That one dude did a video of like all my different looks. It was like 80 Machine Head songs in 8 minutes or something. God damn, dude. I fucking laughed my ass off at that shit.
Nice.
He nailed it. He was awesome.
Yeah. That I love those, you know, when those videos get together and stuff, man. But I will say that there's a podcast out there called The Roach Coach. And what they do is they It's kind of like the Star Wars canon, but they're doing the new metal canon, and they're trying to find what's okay. the best new metal stuff out there. If like an alien came down, what do you show them type stuff? And they reviewed the Burning Red, and you'll be happy to know that they said that the Burning Red is not new metal.
Ah,
actually, they did induct From This Day into the new metal canon, but the rest of the album they said was not new metal. So at least you got that going for you.
Well, you know what's funny is I never even heard that term. New metal when we started, like that term didn't exist.
It didn't.
Yeah. So when we were starting out, we were taking elements of Biohazard and bands like Poison Idea and stuff like Neurosis and stuff. And, you know, the thrash stuff that we grew up here in the Bay Area and a lot of hip hop and combining it into, and even like Alice in Chains and Ministry. And like, it was a lot of shit and it should have never worked. But it somehow did. But there was a big rap influence. But back then, there was no name for it. Like, we just kind of thought it was hardcore. You know, like, in a lot of ways, I think that we kind of used to be almost a hardcore band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that was the vibe. And then I want to say somewhere around, like, 97, like, I started hearing that term, new metal. And then suddenly, we were new metal. And then we were the godfathers of new metal. And it was like, you're the godfather of the new metal. And I was like, okay, cool. And then all of a sudden, new metal was lame. And you're like, oh, you're fucking new metal. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I don't even know any of this shit. Like, we're just metal. That's all I consider us. You know, I've never considered us anything other than that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With a lot of influences.
You know, talking about the new metal tag, obviously Parma 55 was a new metal band. The first album, totally. Definitely.
You guys had the number at the end and everything. So.
Band name, you know, number.
Like every band had to have a number at the end of it. Remember that shit?
Yeah, there's a ton of bands out there with numbers in the name. And I was even in a previous band before that called 12 Volt Negative Earth out of Nashville that had the 12 in it. You know, we were kicking it back then too. But what I'm getting at is, you know, even when I was in that band auditioning for that band, I mean, it's not like I was auditioning for a new metal band. I was just auditioning for a band. I don't think, honestly, yeah. I don't remember anybody. I mean, maybe like rap rock or rap metal or something. You might have been called that. But yeah, definitely the term new metal is something almost newer than any of all that stuff. Yeah. And
I mean, in some ways, you know, I'm going to have Amy send you the record because I really want you to hear it. But, you know, in a lot of ways, there's some new metal on the new record.
It's coming back.
There's some straight up new metal. There's a straight up song where I'm just straight up rapping. Nice. And it's heavy as fuck and it's cool. And I know some people are going to be bent about it. And I know some people are going to be stoked about it. And we just rolled with it. It happened really spontaneously. It's written in like fucking 2 days. And it's a heavy, dark, fucked up song. And it's really cool. It's one of my favorite tracks on the record.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to hearing it, man. And it's funny you talk about like the, you know, the whole new metal thing and kind of having it being like a black eye on the career or whatnot. I remember, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, I'm in Primer. That's cool. And then for a good 15 years, it wasn't cool. And then within the last like 3 years, I'm like, yeah, I was in a band called Primer 55. And people are like, oh my God, you were in a, you know, that was a great band and blah, blah, blah. And I got like interviewed for a book the other day about my time in, you know, for a new metal book for my time in Primer and, you know, with this podcast, I mean, obviously people are coming on and being like, you know, I've seen guests, you know, post about being on the show, like, oh my God, the dude from Primer 55's podcast and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's almost like a badge of honor now to where for years it was like, oh, you were in that band. Oh my God. It was almost like being in Poison, you know, in the 90s or something.
We survived new metal.
Yeah, there you go. Rob Flynn, that's your blabbermouth headline right there. Rob Flynn. Let's jump into, I always have to ask people that got to tour with Pantera, you know, you got a good Dimebag story off the top of your head, some good moments on that tour, you know, being able to tour with those guys.
You know, I was really close with Dime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was definitely the dude that I was closest with. And, you know, we drank a lot. We drank a lot of booze. And, you know, he'd come out to the shows and we'd hang. And I always thought it was funny because we would go back to the clubhouse And I remember we went back to the club. He came to the, I think the Burning Red, it might have been Burning Red or Supercharger. And he came out to the show, and then we hung out, went back to the clubhouse, and we're drinking, and he's playing me the new Pantera record, and it was Reinventing. And we're just rocking it, and we're listening to it, and it got to that song, Goddamn Electric, and I was like, dude, that shit's fucking kill. We're listening to his Cadillac or his Yukon, whatever he had, and we're drinking, and then we go back in, and we're drinking some more, and he, you know, Dimebag's famous for drinking Seagram's or Crown or whatever, and I hate that shit. Like, I hate Seagram's. I hate Crown. I don't like any brown alcohol. I like vodka. And so he was like, come on. He's like, you going to drink some Crown? I'm like, I'm not going to drink no fucking, I don't want to drink no fucking Crown. Like, I was like, just you drink Crown and I'll drink vodka. He's like, no. I got to drink what you're drinking. I'm like, no, we don't have to drink what we're, you know, like we can be individual here. And he's like, no. He's like, I'll drink. So we got Kettle One. We drank a shit ton of Kettle One and we get hammered. It was awesome. It was fun. And I left and woke up. Fucking next show was disaster. Like, I was shattered. And about a week later, we end up in Philadelphia and I got a day off and I'm going into my hotel room and I open my hotel room and inside my hotel is a box. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? And I open the box and it's 4 liters of Kettle One vodka. And it's got a little note in there. Handwritten note. He sent it from Dallas, and a handwritten note from Dime that said, hey brother, good rocking with you the other night. Remember, it's goddamn electric, your brother Dime. And I was like, this motherfucker just spent like $200 to send me some vodka halfway across the country and surprise me and write some little note just because I don't even know why. Like, I was just like, that's fucking rad. Mm-hmm. Like, that was so cool. And to me, that's who that dude was. You know, like, he used to call me on the phone. He used to leave drunk ass fucking voicemails on my fucking phone all the time. And you know, he was something special, man. One of the fucking greatest of all time, as far as I'm concerned. Sick ass guitar player, crushing tone, insane leads, like vibrato and style and flair. And, yeah, man.
Yeah. I got to see him roughly about 12 times, I think, you know, just through the years, and met Dime probably 5 or 6 times, just in, you know, either hanging around the buses or just random moments. And every time you meet him, or every time I met him, I walked away thinking like my new best friend was Dimebag Darrell. You know, right. He just had that. Right. He just had that. That
totally
about
had
him.
That
man.
Ability.
Crazy. And totally. I had gone to Ozfest in Dallas the year that they were playing, and they did an after show for all the bands and the crew and the workers and things like that at the clubhouse. And so I went. It was amazing, man. Dime's just walking around with a tray of shots, like he's a little one of the shot girls, and like handing us all shots and stuff. And just that guy was just larger than life. And I just can't.
Oh my God, so larger than life, on stage and off.
I would have loved to have seen what he would have done with social media. I think he would have just tore it up, you know, give that guy Facebook Live and it would have been over with.
Right.
I know you have the Star Wars guitar, you know, was it Darth Vader on the Explorer?
Yes.
Are you a huge Star Wars guy?
I used to be a huge Star Wars guy.
Okay.
I still of course have my childlike affinity for Star Wars, and of course my unbelievably early dedication to Star Wars. I've kind of let it go at this point. I've let it go, you know, but Vader's still my dude. Yeah. And I got it. Like, I was so fucking stoked to get that guitar. It's got the Vader inlays. Mm-hmm. It's got the Vader, you know, it's sick and it's heavy as fuck. It sounds so good. Baritone Explorer, dude, it's crushing. And, you know, but my Star Wars, I've let go a lot of my Star Wars stuff. When it went to Disney, you know, fuck Disney. And then even just in another way, I had, we held our kids back from watching Star Wars till they were both about 7. So before that, what I did was I knew the Star Wars, especially the first 3, just inside and out. And I'd seen them gajillion times, And so I'd go and I'd read the script, right? And I'd break the movie up into about 10 or 12 chapters, and I'd read about a half an hour of the script. And then I'd go down and I'd, you know, I'd lay with the kids in bed, and they had a big bed, and I'd just sit there and I'd do the music and I'd do the intro and I'd tell, you know, I'd do all the voices and I'd paint the scenery and I'd sit there and kind of tell this, you know, paint all this stuff and then do the dialogue. And I did that for all six movies. So, you know, probably broke it up into almost 70 different stories. And so when they went and saw Star Wars finally, it was a little underwhelming for them because they had imagined this right. fucking amazing world in their own heads. And then they're watching it on going, I don't know. And then I remember when we were watching Star Wars for the first time with my youngest, like halfway through the movie, he's like, "So when does Darth Vader tell Luke that he's his dad?" I'm like, "You're not supposed to know that. Like, what the fuck? Like, you're not supposed to know that, but you do know that because I've told you that story." And everybody knows that story. And at that point, for me, it really was, I really let go. That was the moment that I really let go of Star Wars, because I was like, you know what? It was amazing to watch Star Wars with my kids. Like, it was a fucking dream come true. It was one of the most special days of my life, but they were never going to experience it the way I experienced it. In real time, waiting 3 years for the next movie to come out, not knowing what the story was. Like, Star Wars is such a part of every single bit of our culture. You know, you walk into fucking Taco Bell now and there's Star Wars shit. You walk into the Verizon store, you know, Safeway cereal boxes. Like, it's just everywhere and everybody knows the story. And so they were never going to see it in the same, through the same eyes that I saw it with. And at that point, I was like, you know what? I held on to Star Wars for a long time. I'm happy to let it go right now. And it's cool. And, you know, like, the new movie came out. They went and saw it with their friends the other day instead of me. I was very unhappy about that. Little crummy kids. But I was like, you know, we're going to go see Star Wars again. But, you know, it's been, I don't know, whatever, 5 days now. I still haven't seen it. And I probably won't see it till the weekend. And that's fine.
Yeah, I was going to check and see if you'd seen it yet. This episode will actually be out in January, so it'll have been out for a while. But yeah, I went and saw it. Like I said, I mean, I didn't grow up as a huge Star Wars fan. I honestly didn't see Star Wars until I was 17. I was listening to Machine Head before I was watching Star Wars.
No shit. Nice.
So
much better introduction.
Yeah, right. Actually, I had a very nerdy girlfriend at the time, and when they re-released the movies in the theaters in the late 90s, that's when I went and saw them for the first time, really, was seeing them in the theaters with her. And then the prequels came out, and then obviously with the last few years of the new movies and stuff. So I love the story, and I love everything about it, and I would love to have been a Star Wars nerd as a kid, like, if I would have gotten into it at 7, 8, 9, rather than 17, 18, 19.
Right. Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was fun.
It's probably better you didn't.
Yeah, probably. Well, you know, I got into Kiss when I was like 9. So, I mean, that was, so I'm a nerd on some levels. So you're an Oakland guy. I don't know where you're living these days, but I'm a huge football guy. So I'm trying to wonder, like, what is the Oakland Raiders moving to Las Vegas mean to you? And like, what does it mean to the city of Oakland?
I mean, to me, it doesn't mean a whole lot. I'm a distant Raider fan at this point for no reason in particular. I haven't been to a game in 3 years and, you know, I watch some of the games, I follow them on Twitter, but you know, it's hard being a Raider fan, right? Like, you just suffer and suffer and suffer through decades of losing and a really shitty stadium and a really shitty neighborhood.
Right.
And, you know, that's part of the charm, right? That's part of the charm of why you love the Raiders. And, you know, I think my dad used to take me to the Raider games all the time. And so that's why I grew up on the Raiders. And I grew up on the Giants and I grew up on the Raiders. And, you know, I think you know, I haven't, I'm not going to sit there and be like, I'm the biggest football dude, because I really am not. I'm probably the least football dude of all the dudes in the band. You know, Dave and Phil are by far, like, they walk every Sunday, they're at the bar watching the games, and I just don't care. You know, I'll go to hang, but it's more about the hang for me. Right. It's not about the game. And, you know, I think in the long run, it's going to be tough for Oakland in some ways, because we're losing the Warriors and the Raiders basically the same year. Wow. You know, Warriors moving over to San Francisco. And, you know, so there's going to be a definite financial hole for Oakland to fill. And hopefully they do. But I think for the Raiders, you know, being in Las Vegas, like, it's going to be ignorant as fuck. It's going to be awesome. You know, right. Like, dudes are going to be coming from all over to just rage, you know, at the Raider games. You know, it's going to be insanity.
How far is Vegas from Oakland?
About 14 hours.
Oh, okay.
Drive. It's about an hour and a half flight, though.
There you go.
So you can get there. So it's, you know, and it's a cheap flight. So, yeah, they'll be killing it.
The only time I've ever, I think the only time I've ever been in San Francisco was, we were on tour with Dope and Skin Lab in 2002. We were on the, not the Golden Gate Bridge, but I guess what's the other one, the Bay Bridge maybe?
Yeah, Bay Bridge.
We were sitting in traffic and had the windows down in the van, and Niners were playing Monday Night Football, and like, you see guys with like Oakland stickers on their car just screaming at the guys with like the 49ers stickers on their car. And I just had the windows down and I was just listening to it. And I loved every moment of the passion, and it was an amazing time.
Oh yeah. It's a big rivalry. It's a huge, ridiculous. I mean, like, every time the Raiders and Niners played, you know, the Niners are getting batteries thrown at them and quarters and fucking, they hate it. You know,
that's so funny.
They're like, you Raider fans are dicks. And you know what? In some ways they are. You know, like, even if you're a Raider fan, the Raider fans are dicks to you. Sometimes. I can't even tell you how many times I've been like up in the third deck. Third deck's where all the cheap seats are. Like, you get there in the third deck and some dude walks by you like, hey man, it's where all the fucking gangbangers are and shit. They're like, hey man, dropped your tattoo. I'm like, dude, we're winning. I'm wearing Raiders gear here. What the fuck,
bro? We are on the same team.
Yeah, we're pulling for the same team here.
Oh, good Lord. Couple quick questions about band members, and then I'll wrap it up. But you found Jared through basically a YouTube search. Were you kind of going into that search knowing you were going to find a guy, or was there a bat?
No, we didn't find Jared through a YouTube search.
Submissions, I guess. He submitted.
No, Jared, we took Jared's old band, Sanctity, out with us on the Blackening tour.
Okay.
So his band opened. It was us, the Machine Head headlining, Arch Enemy, Throwdown, and Sanctity opening. Sanctity was on Roadrunner. Mm-hmm. They were a Monty band. And, our bass player at the time had injured his ankle and he bailed from the tour. And so Jared was doing double duty. He would open for us and then he would come in and he did all the vocal harmonies for the whole tour. So we got another bass player to fill it in, but the bass player couldn't really sing that good. And so Jared came in, and so Jared would just walk up on stage, literally sing for, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds and then walk off. And he did all the vocal harmonies for the whole show. And so that's how we got to know him. And he was super cool cat, you know, like he was the singer in Sanctity, and he played guitar in Sanctity also at the time, but I guess he didn't really play on the records. The other guy played everything. And he was just a good dude, man. Like, our voices gelled, and then the tour ended. And Sanctity basically broke up, and we didn't speak to him for 7 years. And then when we started doing the YouTube submissions, he submitted, and we were like, oh shit, it's Jared.
Right.
And we looked at him, and you know, we hadn't talked to him, and he'd cut all of his hair off, so he had super short hair. Looked like Jason Newsted.
He still kind of looks like Jason Newsted. That's funny.
He does. And then he just came out, and you know, he wasn't a sure win, you know, it wasn't a shoe win, because we were just like, I don't even remember what this dude's like, you know, like it had been a long time. And so he flew out, you know, we had a bunch of tryouts, and he flew out, and we took him out to dinner, and it's like the dinner test, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I think you can learn a lot from somebody by just going out to dinner with them. And you can tell if you're going to be able to hang with this dude for a long time just by going out to dinner and seeing how you jive. And we took everybody out to dinner, and just with Jared, man, we just fucking hit it off. And our voices sounded like he played bass, really like a bass player's bass player, like always locking in with the drums, you know, doing lots of total, you know, John Entwistle bass lines and Burton bass lines and that kind of a vibe. And it was cool. And then just when we started singing together, our voices, just the harmonies were crazy. You know, it was just our voices gelled so good. We were like, this is the dude. And so we brought him in, and you know, going on 5 years now with Jared.
Yeah. It's definitely been a long time.
Give me another.
All right, man. So going back to the Davidian video, when there's a close up on your face, the one thing that's always driven me nuts about that is your septum ring is turned just enough to where it's bothered me for the last 20 some odd years. Was there not a mirror or someone there to be like, hey man, you know, your septum ring's
your
a little bit off.
Your fucking septum ring is crooked, you son of a bitch. No, believe me, I wish somebody would have said the thing to me as well. You know, because the director's looking right at me. You know, it's a close-up shot on my face. He could have just been like, hey, man, you know. But no, he didn't. That's funny you brought that up. I haven't thought about that in 24 years, but I remember right when it dropped, I was like, what the fuck?
And what's funny is I went back to watch that video the other day thinking that you're, like, in my brain for the last 20 years, that septum ring is like, sideways, you know, it's like it's pointing due east or something. And I watched it again and I was like, it doesn't even really look that crooked.
But, yeah, it's not that crooked.
It's not, but that back crooked. Then it was,
I mean, that was done in like 2 days, just walking around. You know, we were like basically like guerrilla style everywhere we went. Like, we broke into a warehouse and shot all that stuff in the warehouse. Like, we weren't even supposed to be there. And you know, we got busted by the police a couple of times. We're like, oh, we're just college kids shooting a, you know, test film or something. I forget what the language used was. It was fun. It's good times, man.
Very cool, man. Well, Rob Flynn, man, it was great to talk to you tonight. And hope to talk to you again soon. Good luck with the new album.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Emancipation. Beyond the Hey, this is Wes Borland from Limp Bizkit, Big Dumb Fish, Black Light Burns, Queen Fong, and you're listening to Talk To Me.
Look at me this way. I just need to find my sacred time.